creativity has been democratized, where it was just in the realm of ad lads, guys like me, film and television and so on. It's just so, it's wonderful to see. So, I welcome it.
It's interesting to hear you say that, and I think that's probably a large clue as to why you're still going 27 years later. You weren't that person kind of going, oh, the end is nigh.
Yeah.
The end is nigh. Close yeah. the doors.
Hello and welcome to episode 38 of the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast. I'm your host, Gary Fox. This week, we've something a little bit different for you. We're chatting to Jamie Helly, who's a very experienced entrepreneur. And I was really, really curious to chat to Jamie as he has a wealth of experience in an area I actually know very little about, such as design and branding and working with large clients to deliver large scale branding projects from a whiteboard to seeing it on the shelf. So something I was really interested in, and it was something I felt would bring a lot of benefit to entrepreneurs who are trying to design their own products and their own branding images and stuff. And I thought it would deliver something very, very different to what we've had already. It's a double hit with Jamie. He's a seasoned entrepreneur, and he's someone who can give you an insight into the design and branding process from a really creative brain. He's also walked the walk by starting a second business, which is Mia Chocolate. It's a fascinating story, and we dig into that in the second half. Essentially, they're eating their own soup or drinking their own soup, whatever that phrase is. They're proving they're the best design company in Ireland by creating their own product. And very few companies will stand over their products or their process and service, I should say, in such an extent that they'll create their own product and go, look, we're so good. We created our own product based on our services. So I loved that aspect. And that was the main, I was introed to Jamie by a listener of the pod, and that was the main thing that caught my attention immediately, regardless of all the other successes Jamie's had. It was a really fascinating chat, and he's such a gentleman and a charming person to be around. So it was a pleasure to spend a couple of hours with him. Here we go, episode 38 of the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast. Jamie, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much, Gary.
We chatted last week and I was very keen to get you on. So give us a little overview of what you do.
I run a branding agency, which is a strategic graphic design business, essentially, called Dynamo. We're based in the center of the city, and I'm proud to say we've been going 28 years. What do we do is a question that's always asked of us. Well, essentially, we develop and create brands, brand identity, brand naming, and also, but primarily, I suppose, if you were to ask what our sort of raison d'etre is to help people make their products or services look and feel more enticing, attractive, command a higher premium through what we do in terms of both design and then the story and the narrative and the brand name and the marketing. So, essentially it's come down to that. I started off as a graphic designer, keeping it really simple, but over the years, I suppose, I've developed a small bit of commercialness along the way.
There's a couple of reasons I want to get you on. We'll get on to the hook that brought us together in a while, but when you say 27 years in your agency, that's an incredible time. A lot of our entrepreneurs we've had on are relatively young in their business life. You've seen a huge amount in those 27 years, so I was keen to just tap into that knowledge bank, I guess, and kind of bring us up to speed. So when you started off, you were a graphic designer.
Yeah, I should say as well, 27 years has gone by in an absolute flash. It's absolutely crazy. When I started off, it was in the early 90s, and I graduated college with a VizCom degree, and I did a bit of teaching for a year, and it just wasn't for me. When I look back, I think I had locked-in syndrome. I'm naturally sort of kind of low attention span to a degree, so I like to be doing multiple things at the same time.
Standard entrepreneur, yeah?
Yeah, just a little bit sort of hard to pin down. And after a year of that, I decided I'd go and work as a graphic designer, which I did in a company for a short time. But I decided to leave one day when I went down into the reception and there were two heavies taking out the boardroom table and a couple of machines. So I thought maybe I should probably depart.
I was going to ask you, did you have a big, crisis of conscience? When was the time to leave? But obviously that was pretty clear.
No, literally they were taking the Mac out chairs from under me. So I had no executive interest
You didn't wander through the Phoenix Park business. One day going, what is the meaning? So, okay, what then? Did you say, right, I'm going to work for myself, this isn't going to happen to me again, or what was
I'd always intended to work for myself, but I just wanted to get some real real world experience. So my girlfriend at the time, now wife, her dad very generously loaned me, God, it was £20,000 to set up the business and invest in the business. And it's phenomenal to think that out of that £20,000, £10,000 of that was spent on two Macs and a printer. So it's just unbelievable to see how technology has evolved and how they've been able to reduce the cost so phenomenally. So €10,000 for two pretty lousy Macs, to be honest. And then a contribution to my wage and rent to keep me going for, you know, 6 months or so. And but I'd already had a couple of clients that I really got on well with, so we were up and running fairly quickly.
And what was the reason for going out on your own?
I suppose, God, if I were blunt about it, I'd say financial. I've always, as a kid, I've always cutting grass and working in news agents. I was a motorcycle dispatch rider during the summers. I always had wanted to have access to my own money. So I didn't, and it wasn't because of any other reason other than just being able to look after myself, buy myself a pint and not have to worry about bothering my mum and dad. So it was, I suppose that, I think that was part of the kind of motivation. And then I guess the other thing, the other element of it was freedom. I just can't stand the idea of being locked in a room and having to do a set task for the day, because A, I'd probably be no good at it. And also it just doesn't appeal to me. So I think I'd rather be poor and free than rich and trapped.
That's my biggest reason. Yeah. You've hit the nail on the head for me anyway. So what kind of time were you starting off in? You know, it shocks me sometimes how young some of the listeners to the podcast are. I'm like, oh my God, I think I was finished secondary school when you were
92 or something.
Makes me feel
like
quite
that.
Old. So like, give people kind of a broad strokes overview of kind of, you know, people are like very familiar with, oh, the crash of 2008 and blah, blah, blah. So what year did you start in and what was the
I think probably fair to say we've seen off two recessions, but we've also really benefited from the times leading up to those as well. So we were always able to have a bit of a war chest. But in terms of dates, I think it was sometime around 1993 we set up, and I had a couple of great partners who I was in college with, Brian Nolan and Brian Williams. And we were just a little powerhouse and we really got on together, and the guys were insanely talented. But what happened was, is there was two sort of pieces of sectors that we became very well known in. One was technology. So at the time, you might remember, there was businesses like Iona, Trintech, Baltimore, all doing phenomenal business and making Ireland famous globally. And we were partners with those guys in terms of producing all of their branding, the brand identity and their marketing materials and so on. And that was absolutely incredible. And then the other element of it that kind of was maybe slightly more fun was we did a lot of branding for record labels and bands and artists. Okay. So we did...
Two unlikely bedfellows.
Yeah, quite sort of polar. And so we did a lot of Irish artists, BellX1, Aslan, Boyzone and so on. And that was always great fun. And so they were the two sort of key kind of contributing sectors, if you like. And then I'm not quite sure when the dot bomb was, but to coin my father-in-law's phrase, the arse fell out of it.
Mm.
And literally overnight, all marketing expenditure ceased. There was still the music side of things, but absolutely it was just like a full stop in terms of our turnover.
Think people forget that as well. It's important to note, people have a recency bias in terms of 2008. People think that was the worst thing ever been, and my God. But I think it was 2000, 2001-ish, I think. Was it 1999, 2000, I think, roughly?
Yeah, because actually, because I can remember in 1999, we did the MTV European Music Awards. We did all the branding and the graphics for that. And I remember being at the awards show feeling that we were on top of the world.
We made it!
So what they say... When men make plans, God smiles.
Yeah.
So I think then from there, we were sort of lucky enough that we had a couple of FMCG, which, you know, food and drink clients. And we were working with Bulmers and we were doing a good job on that. And then that sort of began to lead into other food and drink clients and food clients and like people like Glanbia and CNC and Tato and that. And I wouldn't be able to claim that it was a strategic sectoral shift. It was just that we sort of followed the money. And that then sort of got us through. So, and it's been very good to us to this date. So, you know, we're still very, very well known for our skill in brands for food and drink companies, okay. You know, spirits and beers and butters and whatever you like.
So you've seen a massive change. 93, even up to 2000, just the end of kind of where it was primarily print and then just the explosion of digital. So kind of talk us through how that came along.
Okay, well, I can't remember most of the 90s.
We'll skip to 2001.
So that's blurry because I didn't have children at the time and we seemed to spend a lot of time in the front lounge. And I can tell you, it was a lot of fun. Work was an awful lot of fun. There was a huge amount of joy to be had.
Yeah.
I'm not saying there isn't today, but maybe it's a little less so. What was the question?
But forget about the 90s.
Yeah.
How did you guys, you know, you saw obviously the dot bomb happened and things are fundamentally different.
Mm.
So when did digital come along
and become
something that, you know, people were like, you know, it's not like a nice to have anymore. It's something we need to be doing.
Okay. Yeah. No, that's a tremendous question because, so first of all, I think the mainstay of a lot of graphic design businesses had been, I'd say, artificially supported by print, by producing printed materials. So at the time, any kind of core marketing tool was always print. It was always going to be a brochure or a folder or a leaflet or a poster or a campaign, but it was ink on paper. And it was good because the design businesses would manage to print and take a markup of say 10% or so on. But a design business could look at, say if you were doing a turnover of 2.5 million, nearly a million of that could be print. So, and nearly 10% of that could be markup. So it was quite a profitable business to be in. And in some ways it sort of artificially supported the industry because it was a big contributing factor to the company's turnover. And that just all, it didn't, again, not like the technology, it didn't all fall off a cliff. Gradually, print and print became much less relevant, and rightfully so. And then more and more as the digital marketing environment began to show its efficacy. Companies, branding, identity, even ad agencies, began to struggle having sort of existential reality checks. Because I think that the thing that drove the success of digital, particularly in the marketing space, up to, you know, and to this day, has been the search. And the fact that most businesses now would nearly spend half of their advertising revenue in digital, and a huge proportion of that is search. And then a huge proportion of that is now the giants like Google working directly for clients direct. So it's really fragmented the market. A lot of agencies, and I would say ad agencies as well, are to this day learning on the job. The art of digital marketing, I think in the Irish context, there's a few people who do it brilliantly. Absolutely brilliantly in terms of strategic digital marketing. But I think to a large degree, a lot of the communications businesses in Ireland are still adjusting and still sort of evolving and trying to sharpen their proposition. It's not to say we're not there, but it's not to say that we're not getting there.
Mm. You mentioned an interesting point there just about the tech firms. We'll just dig into that for a little bit. Was there a point where you saw all the tech firms coming and you're like, oh, this is great? Was there a point whereby, well, they're just going directly to our clients now?
Yeah, I suppose from our point of view, we don't sell advertising. So the threat wasn't that great in terms of cut in advertising revenues because that's not our sweet spot. What didn't happen, I feel, was any trickle down into the branding agents, a branding agency world, because there's a term called in-housing, which is, it sounds like sort of grow houses or whatever, but basically it's large organizations creating their own in-house agencies, and that they would be advertising agencies or graphic design or branding pieces. So companies like Accenture and Google and Facebook, they will all have large global international in-house agencies. So there's no real trickle down to local agencies. So, so that was something that didn't happen. Unlike the first time round, when a lot of the technology companies were indigenous and needed global marketing materials.
I get you.
This time round, the guys came with their own toolbox and hadn't much need for external. Mm. So that was something that was quite an eye-opener. So in terms of, could I say that having the sort of big five or big six here resident in Ireland, has it made any positive impact on the communications business? I would probably say no.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And take me back then when you guys started. You started with a couple of friends of yours?
Yeah. So a couple of guys from college. We were all in college together in different years, a year apart in each case. And a really great combination of skills. Like Brian Nolan, to this day, is one of the most incredible creative graphic designers, brains I've ever come across. And Brian Williams, who is now directing incredible films for Pirelli and BMW and so on. So a great mix of skills, and me probably, who's the knife and fork guy, ultimately, you know. But... but I think what was really beneficial to us was our relationship. I mean, we were just great mates.
How did come around? How did you all sit down in the pub one day going, do you know what, it'd be great, let's work together?
Well, no, because I started off and I was going sort of 3 or 4 years, and then I approached Brian. Nolan was working in Design Factory and Brian Williams was working for Steve Avril doing U2 covers and all glamorous stuff like that. So at different times I sort of approached him and asked him to come on board, and then we then sort of began to share in the business. So I suppose I sort of drove it, but then it wouldn't have been the success it was without them by any means.
And what were the kind of key moments when you were starting off? How did you get your first couple of clients? I think that, well, I always try to relate this back to people so that if they're starting off now, a lot of people who want to be entrepreneurs listen to the podcast and kind of people who are in their early stages. So when you were starting off, what did you do well that you're like, yeah, that can actually make a big difference?
I suppose looking back, I think one of the definitive projects that I'm most proud of was when we won the pitch to, at the time it was Tina G, it's now TG Kahar.
Okay.
And when we won the competitive pitch to do the new brand for the TV station. And it was absolutely phenomenal for us in that it at last allowed us to be able to produce motion graphics and animation alongside brand and print communications. And it was nationally known, and also it was just, they were just such a terrific bunch to collaborate with. And our journeys down to Spittle were always just very enjoyable and fruitful. And then at one stage before launch, I spent a couple of weeks down there working with our graphics guy at night, because the studio would be busy during the day producing all of the on-screen graphics. So I was creative director on some of the work we were doing, but my day started at 12 o'clock at night. So the surreal nature of waking up in this incredible part of Ireland and being on the tools at the same time, you know, was just phenomenal. Like, amazing sense of peace and serenity, which I just adored. So every aspect of that job, I'm very proud of. And when it, when Tina G rebranded to TG Kahar, that remained to be us as well.
Okay.
So it was always something I look back and say, to this day, it doesn't feel to me that it looks like a time and a place. It still looks very seductive and fit for purpose.
That's interesting. I think everyone has that little moment where they're like, I think this is gonna work. Was that your moment where you're like, I think we'll be all right here?
Yeah. I think the kind of the designer's default state of mind is that your work is rubbish and you're not as good as anybody else, and you tend to look at your work hypercritically, even though you'd be uber sensitive. and look at it and say at the end of it, could have been better. And I don't think it's very often that you come away from a piece of work that you finished that you've done yourself, not necessarily that your agency has done,
right,
that you've done yourself and say, that's kick-ass. So those they're times to savor, mm-hmm, you know, because I always look on enviously at work that I feel I could, you know, I could have done that. But more often than not, you probably couldn't have. Mm. But I'm very proud of our agency's work. I'm phenomenally proud of that. And there's people in the agency who are more talented than I could ever be in two lifetimes. So these days I get a kick out of watching the work that we produce as a group.
Mm. I guess design is so personal. Some of my really good friends are designers. Like, I look at them as if they're creating magic. As if they're literally summoning fire out of their hands. Like, it's just...
Yeah.
It's one of those things. I think it's like having a trade or, you know, being a fantastic writer. I think it's just one of those skills you just... It's magic, you know, you have it in your head.
Yeah. I think when all the moons are in alignment, definitely. I think when you have to go in and be paid to be creative on a daily basis, that's a different type of mindset, but it doesn't mean that it's not enjoyable. But you're right. I mean, I think, you know, creative people by their very nature, whether that be musical or artistic or whatever, generally are held together by thread. And that's a good thing. It's the artistic sensibility, you know. Mm. If that's what it takes, and that's how you need to be wired to do good work, then you know that's what it is.
What makes you great can also be your biggest burden, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
So you talked about your agency there and how proud you are of people working for you. How did you grow that? How did you go from Jamie sitting there on his Mac bashing out the ads to like, okay, now we actually have caught something here?
Mm.
How do you know to go, right, this is the moment whereby, okay, we need someone else.
Mm. I think that, again, ambition, obviously, I mean, it's would have been the driver. I think myself and my two partners, after 10 years, very amicably decided that we were going to go different ways. And I think, you know, I felt very commercially sort of headstrong in terms of where I wanted the agency to go. And I've always sort of looked at UK agencies that I admire enviously and want to be that. And I suppose that would be my sort of, would have always been my sort of benchmark. And so there comes a time when we, the three of us, had to look at each other and say, well, do we want to be a bespoke agency doing beautiful work? Or do we want to make films and television ads? Or do we want to be a big ad agency scale branding agency? And each of us wanted different things. And so I wanted the middle one. Then I started, I suppose, to shape my brain in more of a commercial way and start to look at the the commercial elements of the business and how to grow that. And that then became one of the sort of more enjoyable aspects of my job, was just seeing the turnover increase, seeing more people coming on board, more disciplines taking place, and bigger cultures happening. So when you sort of look out and there's 28 people there, and you think everybody here has dogs and kids and mortgages and so on, instead of feeling like a weight of responsibility, I just feel, and this is genuine, I just feel like a sense of privilege. I suppose it was my sort of grubby ambition to be a bigger UK scale agency that sort of drove it. Mm-hmm. I'm glad I took that road.
It's interesting you say privilege. I actually had this exact same conversation with an entrepreneur yesterday, and she was like, it's, you know, when you wake up and it's payday, and you know you have to make sure everyone is paid because they've got exactly, like you say, mortgages. Yeah. And how did you balance that then as a small business or a young business? How did you go, right, okay, this is how we balance everything up? Because that can often be very difficult. She made a great point yesterday. She goes, when a lot of people start, they don't think of the practicalities of like, well, that client will pay you net 30 days.
Yeah.
Or that client will pay you in 2 months or 3 months.
Yeah.
You seem to have got a very sharp grasp of the commercial aspect very quickly.
Well, let's not go nuts now.
Hindsight is great.
I think there's a lot of information kept from me.
But I think some people can never make that, can bridge that gap. They can be unbelievably creative, but they can never bridge that gap between going, I'm going to create this beautiful piece of work, the kind of torture genius you talked about there, and they'll agonize over it for 2-3 months.
Yeah.
But won't send the invoice.
Yeah.
I talked to someone like that recently. I was like, okay, trying to advise her.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, you've done all this work. you know, how much did you charge?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't feel it was right to charge them.
Yeah, yeah. Again, that goes, to that point again, that goes back to the sort of creative mind and the insecurity of putting value on what you do. Mm. I think Irish people tend to be a little weak with that narrative in terms of, you know, understanding that there is a proper value to what they produce. In terms of sort of looking out and not panicking about all of the responsibility of and commitments, I've sort of probably always had a bit of a misplaced confidence in my own abilities. And also I have a really, really brilliant team in finance who've been with me for, you know, one person particularly over 2 decades.
Wow.
And they sort of know how to manage me. So I really don't get sort of brought into scenarios unless there's a sort of a chronic cash flow problem. And I might have to just jump on a call or go and have a coffee with somebody. And so from that part of things, I sort of actively ignore a lot of that. So okay. I'm at my best when I'm not stressed and I'm with clients. But I'm not at my best if I'm anxious about or making all ends meet. So I just try and to get the guys to help me to just, be at my best, essentially.
How did you get that self-awareness? Because I think that's one of the biggest traits of a great entrepreneur, is knowing what you're not good at. Some of us have a blind faith, especially when you start, that you're like, oh yeah, sure, I'm great at everything. I can do a bit of finance, I can do a bit of marketing, I can chat to clients. How did you sit down and go, right, this is what I'm good at, this is what I'm bad at? How did you have that conversation with yourself?
Well, I've always tried to have good mentors to help me along the way. And they might be friends, or they might be kind of people, professionals who I pay to help me. And I've always sort of understood the fact that I can't be good at everything. And I'm not good at everything. I'm good at some things. I'm not brilliant at a lot of things. I'm okay at some things. So I'm able to compartmentalize and be able to sort of try to play to my strengths. And I do that as much as I can. So in terms of how did I ever come to the conclusion I needed to sort of segment the tasks and step away from aspects of the business, I can't say there was any one single point in time where I came to that conclusion. But all along the way, I've had just great people, smarter guys and girls than me, helping me realize that you don't have to be the dude that does everything, you know? And so I think that's kind of finally beginning to sink in.
Just to touch back on something you said there, having so much over 2 decades, I think nowadays is phenomenal.
Yeah, it's good and bad. At the moment, we're really enjoying taking a really serious look at our business and our proposition. And we've been changing over the years, and we're sharpening our proposition and being more fit for purpose as a branding agency. And it's the pressures on an agency these days are, I would say, you know, fivefold what they were 10 years ago easily, because the pressures that are on our clients, where marketing departments have been decimated since 2010-11, where there would have been a marketing department of 14 people, just now maybe 2. Okay. And that marketing person would be also like a commercial officer as well as a marketing officer. So the pressures that they are under are absolutely immense. So it's not as if clients have become weaponized or more, you know, predatory in terms of how they work with their agencies. The fact of the matter is that we're stretched a lot more. And commercially, then, the sort of requirement for return on investment for creative services is a huge portion of how the marketing budget is separated. So if you have a digital spend, you can very easily see, because of the data that you'll get,
of course,
how effective. And also it's very agile, because you can change on a daily basis and adapt campaigns. But it's much, much, much more nebulous as a branding agency. Well, what difference did that label and that name for that whiskey make to the ultimate ROI or profit of that? So it is a little bit more nebulous. It's not to say that there isn't huge return on investment. There is. It's just a little harder to quantify. It's a very, very hard environment out there. And creative agencies like ourselves have this paradox where you have to be ruthlessly commercial, but you also have to be ruthlessly creative. And two ends of the world are opposite sides of the world. And it's trying to find that sweet spot and not stress people out, because creativity cannot work in a state of fear.
Yeah. We need just your brain just shuts down. Give me something fantastic, yeah.
Yeah, tell me what you want and I'll do it. But you just, ideas just don't flow. But then the client's demands, because of the pressures that they're under, are also very huge. So it's a balancing act. I'm not saying it's hard to manage, but it's a lot tougher than it was.
Mm. What do you think is driving that? Is it just the job losses? Or are people, I'm kind of asking you a question and slightly giving you the answer, in terms of people are now demanding immediacy, the immediate results. I'm turning on my Facebook ads today, oh, I'm going to see an ROI of 5. I'm turning on my Google ads, I'm going to see ROI.
Yeah.
Has people's mindset changed about how they do things?
Oh, phenomenally. I mean, the speed of response has completely multiplied by massive factors. And that has had a sort of effect on creative response. So I think, you know, in years gone by, if an agency, either a branding agency like ourselves or an ad agency, were tasked with coming up with a number of creative concepts, 2 to 3 weeks would have been given. Now the working methodology is much more agile, so the client will want to have what's called tissue sessions, which means sort of
in between. Sorry, tissue sessions?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll go with that.
Yeah, I never thought of it that way, but I'll never think of it any other way from now on. But basically kind of work in progress and sketches and see how you're doing. So it's much more collaborative and iterative, but it's much more fast paced. So tissue session meaning layout pad, paper, scribbles, rip off, throw in the bin, scribbles,
right,
rip off,
okay.
And go in the bin. So it's a much more collaborative way of working, and it's terrific because it's great for the client relationship. And, you know, I have a theory that absolutely everybody on this planet is creative. Just most of us don't have the confidence to actually come out and admit it, or it's never been brought out in us. So the original question, yes, work is expected much, much, much quicker. The ways of working have absolutely changed because software is phenomenal. Sharing visuals, visualizing concepts to clients has become much more streamlined. And also then iteratively, you know, the client fundamentally can make real-time changes, you know. So yes, it's it has had a huge effect on the speed of response needed.
And now a quick word from our sponsors. This week's episode is sponsored by nobody. That's right, we don't have any sponsors. In 2020, we will be looking at opening up the pod to a series of sponsorship opportunities. We'll be doing 3 seasons of around 10 episodes each, so people can get involved and sponsor a season. Obviously, they'd have to be someone that we'd tie in very well with, someone who ideally would use their product. So if that is you, drop me a mail and we'll have a chat. And now we jump straight back to our chat with Jamie Helly.
Just thinking, actually, I didn't ask you at the very start. Anyone's not familiar with a design or branding agency,
yeah,
explain it as if we're 5.
Oh, I hate this question. So what I do is I would tend to sort of do it in give an example.
Yes,
so,
yeah, perfect.
And I'll use a food and drink example. So you're an entrepreneur and you've decided that there is an opportunity for you in the whiskey market globally, as you know, because at the moment, of course, there's lots of opportunity because of the growth in Irish whiskey. And so you don't have time to, or money to create a distillery. It's 3 years from inception before you start producing liquid. But you have access to, and you come along and you have procured and crafted a whiskey that you feel is a very superior or at least a world-class piece of product. So you come along to Dynamo, you say, okay, I have an idea for a whiskey, but I don't know how I'm going to brand it, what it's going to be called, where I'm going to position it in the market, what that narrative might be in terms of the story, and how can you help me? So that's sort of a clean sheet of paper.
Yeah, so makes sense.
As a branding agency, we would then work with the client. We'd look at the competitor set. We would try and sort of identify where there might be gaps in the market in terms of Irish whiskey propositions, but in relation to what's happening in other spirit sectors, in Scotch as well as bourbon, and, you know, and out of different territories, what's happening in Japan and so forth. So, but we try and assess a sort of a piece of white space where our brand could live. And then we sort of look and help to develop a story for that, to meet that particular positioning or proposition that we want to go for. And the core element of this is that every brand and brand story needs to have at its basis some truth. So we don't try and pick out stories out of the ether. And
the origin myth, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then, but if you look, there's some terrific examples of how that is done. And I mean, I think Hendrix was named from picking a name out of a phone book.
Really?
You know, and so, you know, when you kind of, when you sort of look and scratch under the surface, yeah. I might get into trouble with this, but the majority of the Captain Morgans sold, the sort of this, their base product is not rum. So if you look at the label, it'll say a rum liqueur. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah, so I've lost a potential client there. So. but anyway, so we would help then craft and develop a genuine story, create a name, the packaging design, so it would be unique and disruptive when sitting alongside its competitors. And then the marketing material and how that story is told through the different channels, whether that's digital or even in-store point of sale or sales collateral or advertising. Mm. So it's that. It's somebody coming in with a beautiful whiskey, beautiful tasting, absolutely on every level, terrific product, and then letting us do our work. An example of that, I think, would be Lambay Whiskey, which is the Barings family on Lambay Island in partnership with Camus, who are, I think they're about the fifth or sixth largest cognac maker in the world.
Oh, wow.
Again, amazing collaborators come to us with the idea for the whiskey. Ireland, unlike Scotland, where they're littered with islands, and the island aspect of the brand, the brands that they create, are core parts of it. The opportunity here is Ireland. We don't have an island whiskey. So Lambay is it could be the first Irish whiskey that claims an Irish island provenance. And so we work with them. We produce a terrific brand. It's in 22 countries. It's outperforming all expectations. And it was a white sheet of paper. So does that kind of explain it?
That's a brilliant example. Yeah, no, I completely get it. So you'll go right back from blank sheet of paper right up until pick one off the shelf.
Yeah.
We're going to touch on that actually in a few minutes. That is one of the main reasons why we talked. Has it become extremely noisy in the brand space? Because with social media, you know, there's so many, you're exposed to so many brands on a daily basis.
Yeah. I mean, it's absolutely phenomenal. And, you know, the road is paved with skeletons in terms of innovation and new brands. Yeah. And in particularly in the food and drink sector, I feel that the opportunity to fail is great because of the noise. Mm. That's why design and narrative has never been so important, because the people coming up, I hate using the Gen Zs and millennials and all of that, but the people coming up who are the future luxurians and the future consumers of products, their sense of understanding of design and creativity and aesthetics is way, way beyond what we were when we were kids. Mm. You know, when we were kids, we were, you know, the biggest exposure we had to art was albums and record sleeves, which we used to absolutely, you know, all eat up as kids. You know, you spend hours in record shops just enjoying the art. And now their sensibility, because they're so exposed to beautiful design work, whether that be on Instagram or Pinterest or just in their general surroundings, in just general communication, the noise that's out there. But there's so much beautiful work aesthetically. So it's not only now important that your brand and your message is right and your product is good, but you have to compete in that environment. So, you know, eye candy is a word I would use as well. So, you know, when you produce a product, how you represent that and present it in a digital context is really important. So, you know, how that comes to life, whether that's for a finance business, a law firm, or a food or drink brand, how it lives in the digital world and how it, when it's glanced at for 2 or 3 seconds, is really, really important. So design has actually never been as important. The issue or the problem is just to convince marketers that it does have that value, because as I said, it's quite nebulous. So, oh my God, it's so noisy, but there is so much beautiful design and creativity around us. So the internet, for all its nastiness and dark corners, has also democratized creativity. And be that
everyone's creative. You said earlier about everyone's creative.
It's nuts.
You look at some people's Instagram feeds and you're like, my God, that's better than a professional photographer.
Yeah.
The thought and care and just the angle, it's phenomenal.
Yeah, I know.
just be like, I see some people, there's a young Irish guy, he's a videographer, I follow him, he's in Bali at the minute. My God, like,
yeah.
If you saw it on a movie set, you'd be like, oh wow, nailed it.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I think it's phenomenal. Yeah. It's democratized it hugely.
Oh, completely. You know, photography, illustrations, and being exposed to beautiful street art like Subset or Maser, or even then how it works in YouTube, and being able to create your own beautiful little movies or films or comedy sketches. Or so it's brilliant. Creativity has been democratized, where it was just the in the realm of, you know, ad lads, guys like me, film and television and so on. It's just so it's wonderful to see. So, you know, I welcome it.
It's interesting to hear you say that. And I think that's probably a large clue as to why you're still going 27 years later. You're not, you weren't that person kind of going, oh, the end is nigh.
Yeah.
The end is nigh. Close the doors.
Yeah.
But it's
care and attention to detail as well. And we always say, like, kind of, you know, for clients to sort of witness our give a shitness, you know, and I have to credit Richard Seabrook who's for that. And also he's one of my collaborators I have to mention as well along the way in terms of helping define who we were as well as a business. So it's phenomenal.
Talk to me about chocolate. What brought us together was a bar of chocolate.
Well, it was kind of a fortuitous thing that happened, actually. We had a client, Brett Beach, who called us, I don't know, out of the blue from Belgium one day about 4 or 5 years ago. And he had co-founded a confectionery brand called Madacas. And he's ex-Peace Corps. The overriding principle around the product that he was involved in was beautiful luxury chocolate, but made entirely from locally sourced Madagascan cocoa and vanilla. So it was kind of branding our products with purpose before that was a thing. and so we he then parted ways with his partner. We had been working with them, and I think they had maybe sort of ideological differences. And Brett gave us a call and said, I love working with you guys. I can't go near the chocolate business for a year and I can't afford you. So have you any suggestions? And
what an open question. I like this guy just purely from that question. You know, didn't really know, but was just trying to nearly do something.
Yeah, just get to the feckin' point.
Just ask the question.
Yeah, please, yeah. God. So we thought, okay, this is a terrific opportunity to do a joint venture. And so we decided, okay, well, we'll invest €250,000 worth of time and hours, and we'll take a stake in the business. And again, it was terrific as a white sheet of paper. And we'll produce a brand where we have an absolutely incredible story, because we are going to manufacture and make our product entirely in Madagascar. It is going to be pitched at the luxury market in Europe. And so incredible provenance, brilliantly principled, you know, and a true and honest idea. So we worked on that, and we looked at, it's a very, very crowded marketplace, particularly in the UK in terms of luxury confectionery and chocolate. And but we ploughed ahead, and we developed a brand called MIA, which is Made in Africa, which is what it stands for. Or Missing in Action. I prefer Made in Africa. But it's also my daughter's name, my youngest daughter's name. So, and out of the, and from here, we developed this beautiful product of real delicious, amazing, incredible chocolate. And stunning packaging, actually, I have to say. We won an award in New York last year, and it was a terrific ceremony. We were in the Guggenheim, and we all felt very flash.
Oh, nice.
But the product we've been going for 3 years. We're now in 8 countries, and including America, in Whole Foods in America and in the North Atlantic, and in Texas, in Central Market across Texas, and Whole Foods in the UK. We've won 3 Great Taste Awards in the UK last year and 1 the year previous. Yeah, it seems to be going well. And it's brilliant for us because as a marketing story, it just kind of demonstrates that, put your money where your mouth is. You think this stuff flies. Well, just demonstrate that.
And, I love this story. There's so many factors I love about this story. And that is it. That's what grabbed my attention when I was told about you. I was like, oh, this guy, you need to chat to him. Really interesting guy, started his own chocolate brand. I was like, oh, yeah, there's a lot of people starting chocolate brands now. It's kind of the sexy thing to do.
Civilians.
And they're like, no, he has his own marketing agency and he's proving that they're the best by starting their own brand. I mean, I love that story.
Thank you very much.
But I think it's so rare nowadays that people are like, well, we're an amazing agency.
Yeah.
And we started our own brand to prove it.
Yeah.
And we put it in the market and we've, like, 250,000, like you said all that as if, you were telling me we're going to go have lunch next and we're going to have chicken wings. And like, it was very matter of fact, but like what you've done is something that most people would never attain to. I would never put, never mind their money. I mean, €250,000 is huge.
Yeah, well, it's a time investment, but it's an actual tangible investment when the planes are stacked and those hours could have been charged to clients. So, you know, when you look back and your financial director looks back on the hours and you quantify it in numeracy, it is not a fictional number, but completely worth it. If not for any other reason than, it's a genuine sustainable story. And like we employ 7 people in Madagascar, which is absolutely an incredible thing to be able to say. And then one day when we sell enough bars, there might be some budget for me actually to go down there.
You're on one of my questions. I was going to ask, what's it like? I've only ever seen the movie with the penguins.
Maybe I'll just Skype in.
It looks like a phenomenal place.
It's to be proud of. And one of the things that we're most proud of, and we got a lot of help from Conal O'Connell, who has an NGO called Proudly Made in Africa. And because of him, also, he was able to identify and develop a supply chain in Madagascar as well. So they would get into a place where they would be sort of match fit to be able to produce a luxury product.
Okay.
So there's a lot of people involved. I mean, we're at the sort of the fluffy marketing end. So, but to be able to say that you're involved in something that has genuine purpose and might one day turn a profit is it's something to be proud of. But by no means
But dig into that a little bit. Just you actually told me about that when we met first over at your Lovely Bar of Chocolate. What normally happens is the beans are there, they're put in the bag and they're shipped away.
Yeah, this is a crazy statistic that over 70% of the world's vanilla comes from Madagascar.
That's interesting.
None of it is processed, and there's no value added to that in Madagascar. So that ships out in bags. And the same with cocoa. Africa supplies 80% of the world's cocoa, but only produces 1% of the world's chocolate. So
they're crazy.
It's nuts, isn't it?
They're genuinely
in this
shocking.
Day and age, it's absolutely it's crazy. And this is Mintel data. This is not kind of these aren't made up on the spot statistics. As you know yourself, if you're sort of if you're dealing in commodities, you're victim to market fluctuation and predatory buying habits and so on. So part of the idea with this was we're saying, okay, it's not just fair trade in that you get a fair market rate for your product. It's fair made, whereby if the people have a hand in the manufacture and production of it, there's the other trickle down benefits of that and into their supply chain as well. So, but it's just a crazy statistic that then, that there's huge opportunity there for people who want to sort of assist, but commercial opportunity as well, but assist communities in Africa to be able to produce meaningful, saleable, marketable, profitable stuff. You know, and I suppose in some way this demonstrates that it can be done. And the other thing that we wanted to do as well is, yeah, and you've seen the packaging, Gary. We didn't want to make this look like typically sort of semiotic African cliche,
yeah.
Bias because we're fair trade, and you know this is a bullseye luxury product. Mm. It's a luxury price point. It's £4 for 75 grams. It's worth every penny.
I can attest to that. I took it home.
Dynamite.
I was raging. I went to the shelf yesterday and my wife had put back in one of the wrappers. I was like, oh, there's one left.
I'm flattered.
I know. And it was gone. She needed it. I was raging.
I think
it's
all
phenomenal.
Of the samples in our office are just empty boxes.
It was very clever what she did. Just left back the wrapper. But even like the box, the display box,
yeah,
you gave,
yeah,
like it's so rich, it's so luxurious feeling, you
and
know?
All of that print, and it's all manufactured in Africa, so and that just attests to the manufacturing capabilities for luxury items. And just, you know, my head isn't filled with statistics about this, but just from my anecdotal knowledge, you know, luxury branding and luxury is the sustainability aspect of is now of their strategies is massive. So, you know, brands like LVMH take their sustainability ethics very, very seriously. And not necessarily because they're looking for sainthoods, but because it's a table stake for young consumers and luxurians that they expect their brands to behaving responsibly for their workforce, their supply chain, the environment, animal welfare. And that's here to stay. Mm. And it's only good.
This year has been a massive change.
It's nuts, isn't it?
Do you know how sometimes you feel things moving slowly?
Yeah.
And then suddenly it's there and it's everywhere. I was at a talk a couple of months ago, maybe a month ago, with Ryanair's chief marketing officer. And all he talked about was green.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gum green. Now, they're the best in the business at getting their message across.
Yeah.
Framed it at the start, put up the slide. This is what I'm going to talk about today. I'll talk about the other stuff, but this is what I'm going to talk about.
Yeah.
The shit sandwich. He put it up at the start, then talked about the stuff in the middle, and then put it up at the end again.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, he really framed it really well. But it struck me how much focus he had put on green. Going green, carbon neutral. And I was like, when Ryanair are putting that up there,
yeah,
you know, like 5 years ago,
yeah, there'd be, you know, a ruthlessly profit orientated business.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
But when they're doing that, they're seeing it as this isn't cost.
Yeah.
This is something we have to do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I know, it's wonderful. And also the rise of vegetarianism and veganism is phenomenal. But just to the earlier point, my eldest daughter, Jo, she's studying animation in Dundee. She's asked that for this Christmas that any clothes we buy are not high street or fast fashion.
That's
so
interesting.
I can go across the road to Shoppa Ella and buy a Sage's Quo denim jacket and I'll be a hero.
You're gonna quit? No
yeah,
problem.
Yeah, the job's good.
Thanks, that.
So,
that's very
it is real. And the other thing then, I was on my way down to a meeting a few months ago and I was stopped for Burger King on the way. And there was a kid in front of me, maybe sort of 21 or whatever. And she was with, obviously sort of in college with a couple of her mates. And she ordered the vegetarian option. And me being just very nosy, I said, do you mind me asking you, like, is the vegetarian option any good here? And she said, it's absolutely phenomenal. And I said, so how many people are vegetarian in your class? She was in, I think she was in Maynooth. And she said, when I started, there was maybe, you know, 4 or 5%. Now she said 40% of us are either vegetarian or vegan.
What's the other one? Flexitarian, is it? Meatless Mondays and all that kind of jazz. Like it's huge.
What does Dylan Moran say? He's a vegetarian, but he's just one of those ones that eats a lot of meat.
But I think everyone's taken, I think it ties into a broader trend as well in terms of health.
Yeah.
People are far more focused on
their
health.
Yeah, yeah.
It's also quite hard to make through the noise as well. I think from a branding design agency aspect, that must be quite interesting in terms of there's so much stuff getting packaged as good for you now.
Yeah.
Or this is great for you, or added protein, or added this, or added that. How do you see that trend kind of rising up?
I suppose primarily, I think what's going to and what is going to be happening in our business as regards food and drink is going to be the physical packaging that is going to change. So, I mean, it's one thing for a brand to claim, you know, sustainability credentials in terms of whether that be sort of environmental or animal welfare, but then to put the product into a plastic bottle or an unrecyclable cardboard pack or a foil pack is, you know, it doesn't really fulfill on the promise. So I think the kind of effect and the responsibility for us in this particular area is to help source and promote genuinely sustainable raw materials as well. And, you know, and see what's happening out there in the world of plastics and cardboard and being able to kind of figure out more ingenuitive ways to package food so as it does live up to its sustainable promise. So that's a really exciting portion of it. And that's an area where we're developing our expertise in terms of what's happening globally. So we can bring it to the local market and say, this is a new material. It's just been developed in Korea. It's an amazing substrate. We could use it for this particular product. But we'd see if it stacks up from a commercial point of view. So I can see it affecting our business in a positive way in terms of taking more responsibility for the raw materials.
I'm just thinking of all the ring pulls and then the six pack of beers and the four cans of Coke that just come in the ring pull. And now they have the paper. Like, that gets massive exposure. Every couple of months, a company jumps on it going, oh, look, not using ring pulls anymore. We're using, like, you know, paper. I think it was Coke bought a large print manufacturer.
Oh, sorry.
And now they use the paper as the pickup instead.
And that paper hopefully has come from a recycled source and will go back there.
How do you
keep
on top of trends? Like, you've talked a lot about looking abroad and, you know, I'm fascinated by trends, just trying to spot what's up and coming. How do you guys do that?
I work with somebody, Roshi Naranya, and she is a strategic planner. And we just work, like, in harmony together all of the time. Her appetite for what's happening globally is absolutely insatiable. And we subscribe to expensive networks, one being the Future Laboratories in the UK and LSN Global. And we get regular dispatches on innovation around the world, but also we can request specific data around particular, either whether it's a trend or it's a new materials that are coming into the market, but mostly to do with consumer trends and attitudes and so on like that. So that is a huge, because you could lose yourself down rabbit holes.
That's the
problem. If you just use Google as your starting
point. Too much noise.
No,
you need
absolutely.
A filter. And I think that's a big business opportunity for a lot of people is filtering.
Yeah.
Becoming filters.
I
literally just subscribed to a newsletter. Not anything like yours, but it's called Trends. It's run by this company called The Hustle. And basically every Tuesday they send you out the five emerging startup trends.
Yeah.
You know, like pea protein is becoming big or this game is becoming big. Or people are searching for veganism.
Yeah.
And trying to spot opportunities. But like, I think you need to filter because
it needs to be curated.
It's overwhelming.
Yeah. You'd faint if you tried to go through.
You know, I think that's what newspapers used to do. They used to filter down what was important and they've kind of become sidelined. But I think curation and filtering is a massive business opportunity for people as well.
Yeah. And then what we try to do then is in order for our clients to benefit from that as well. So, you know, once or twice a year, we sort of pull together a bit of a book of knowledge of insights that we're garnering from around the world and sit down with our client, have a bit of lunch and go through presentation about, you know, this is happening in your sector, but here's what's happening in other sectors. And it's a bit mind blowing and it's all very enjoyable to take part in.
I love that. I think that's where companies are really going to thrive. The entrepreneur I was interviewing for this week's episode, her business is based in education. Everything she does about educating her clients, her customers, webinars, everything's about education.
Wow.
Educating people first.
Yeah.
And then everything follows after. And it's been phenomenally successful for her.
Incredible.
I think that's where a lot of marketing is going in terms of like curation and editing, because it's overwhelming.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you go buy, if you were to buy a chocolate bar today, thousands of choices.
Which one of these 600 do you want to choose?
You go into Fresh. Let's say that's our Whole Foods. You go into Fresh. Yeah. It's like, oh my God.
Yeah.
And then your brain short circuits and you just go for the one you always
just go for a toffee crisp.
But, you know, it's an interesting space. We're almost out of time. I'm conscious of keeping you because you've got a very good big award ceremony to go to today.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Not that I'm participating, I'm not.
You're the judge, that's the most important job of all.
Yeah.
You wield the actual flower.
Yeah.
Just tell me how I'm kind of very interested in kind of like, you know, balance and focus and how you sustain performance over a long period of time. You've done it for quite a while.
Uh-huh.
How do you balance the personal and the business in terms of looking after yourself?
Yeah. Well, that's a heavy question. I'm married to the best woman in the world, and we're just great mates. I have three beautiful daughters. So being at home is absolutely fun. It's always been fun. So the sort of work-life balance has always been very easy easy to maintain. The other thing as well, as I think, is the sort of the stuff that you do out of work, which is naturally very important and some people get their kicks out of, you know, or, you know, some exercise is obviously really important and hobbies and stuff. So I have a number of daft hobbies that actually sort of, you know, keep me really sane.
Go on, I'll bite. Go on, tell me.
I'm very much into motorcycles. And,
okay.
I do a lot of track days on motorcycles.
Okay.
And that's something that really gives me a buzz.
That'll clear the head, I'd say.
Oh, Jesus, yeah. Gives you a great sense of your own mortality.
And what else?
Not so much anymore, but I have a private pilot's license and I enjoy, did enjoy flying, but not...
Adrenaline junkie.
Yeah,
but... for the last 60 minutes here. Kept that very quiet.
That's in the last couple of years, less so, because I think as I'm kind of progressing with the motorcycles, it's becoming a harder mistress to leave.
Those are kind of like...
strangely enough, my wife seems to be okay with them both, so...
I was going to ask you that. Yeah. How does she balance that off? Does she...
Well, she asked me once, if I asked you to stop, would you? And I went, probably not. And then she says, well, then why, you know, what's the point? So it's only going
to
cause friction.
She's just trying to be fair.
Yeah, go for it. And a couple of times when I've fallen off the bike and I've called her and I said, like, I'm okay or whatever. And she says, can you get back on your bike? And I said, I think I can. She says, go for it. You know,
nice.
So she's just a cool chick.
Very cool. Excellent. I think we'll wrap it up on that. That's fantastic.
Okay.
We've one final question.
Yeah.
Each week we give away a book that's kind of made an impact on you or that you've just enjoyed. All people have to do to win a copy or to be in a chance to win a copy is to tag Dynamo on social media, so any of your social accounts, and to tag myself as well, Mr. Gary Fox. So what book, Jamie, has made an impact on you or you've enjoyed?
Well, I'm a little bit of a lightweight in that I started to use Audible. So I listened to books and somebody told me recently, isn't that kind of cheating?
It depends on what it is. I love Audible, but only for certain types.
Yeah. Would you prefer fiction on Audible?
I can't really process non-fiction on Audible because I get kind of like almost anxiety about not understanding.
Yeah.
So if you're out for a walk or you're driving the car and he's talking about like, I started listening to this guy, the Bulletproof Coffee guy.
Yeah.
He's talking about this milligrams that he takes every day. And I'm like,
yeah,
I don't know what to do with that information. You know, I'm kind of wasting my time.
Yeah.
But you know, it's certain books, biographies.
Yeah.
History, anything like that, I listen to on Audible.
Yeah.
That I can just enjoy the story.
Yeah.
That I'm not kind of trying to learn.
To sort
much.
Of, yes, it's not you school. Know,
try, yeah, my brain isn't like short circuiting as I'm driving off the N11, kind of going, right, what do I do here? Like, can't multitask. So, yeah. I do like Audible.
I have to say, the best book I've listened to /read is in a long time is The Nix by Nathan Hill.
The Nix.
Yes, The Nix. Nix, N-I-X.
Okay, we'll put it on the show notes as well.
Nathan Hill, and it's an absolutely terrific read. Big American saga, very funny. It's like a long short story you'd read in Vanity Fair it's an incredibly funny. So I recommend it. And if you do listen to it on Audible, a big factor is always the narrator. Terms of how you enjoy, the level of how you enjoy the book.
That's
in the first
huge.
Place.
Sometimes you're like, oh, I can't, just can't listen to him.
Yeah, I can't cope with
too much.
16 hours of
it's
that.
It's 6:30 in the morning and you are too much.
Well, the narrator for Nathan Hill, or for The Nix, is absolutely phenomenal. So it's a really good listen.
Brilliant. Jamie, thank you so much. Pleasure.
Thank you, Gary.
Where can people, actually, before we finish, where can people learn more about Dynamo, yourself, and Mia?
Well, very easy. It's the easiest URL in the world. It's dynamo.ie.
That's in the early name.
Yeah. And then and then within there, there's our case study on Mia, which if you click through, will take you to the shop as well.
Brilliant. Great. And yourself, if people want to connect with yourself or send you a message, where can they?
Jamie@dynamo.ie. Keep it simple.
Keep it simple.
Yeah.
Rules to live by. Jamie, thank you so much.
Thanks a million.
And that's it, a wrap on another episode as we creep towards the end of the year. If you'd like to win the book that Jamie talked about, simply tag myself, Mr. Gary Fox, and Jamie Helly and Dynamo Design Agency on any social media that you like. And if you did enjoy the episode, do drop me some feedback. I absolutely love it. It makes my week when someone drops me a line on LinkedIn or Twitter or Instagram or wherever you like and tell me what they thought of the podcast. Doesn't always have to be great stuff. It can be how I can improve. It can be guest suggestions. It can be anything you like. So that is it. Thank you so much for listening.